genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
My next guest is going to apply entrepreneurial thinking to things the government can do to solve this economic crisis. We're actually very lucky to have him. He was testifying before Congress this morning, so we're grateful that he's joining us today. He lives by the quotation, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." That saying implies that we learn from the past to avoid errors in the present. If you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008, 639-0008. Stanley Koss is a historian, an adjunct professor, an author, an entrepreneur, and interestingly enough, a former Italian Basketball Association player. He was the U.S. Senate Republican nominee in 1994 from the great state of West Virginia. He has numerous degrees, including a BA, a master's, and a PhD. I won't go into all of that because we're pressed for time. Interestingly enough, fate twisted, gave him an interesting twist in his career in 1983. Stan discovered some 18th century Philadelphia shipping records in his attic and has become a history junkie ever since then. Welcome to the show, Stan. How are you today?
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on testifying before Congress. But we don't have time to get into all of that right now. You do say, however, that history has a lot to teach us about getting out of the economic morass that we are currently in, and you've got 13 principles to do that. We may not have time to go through all 13, so I just want to hit on a couple that I found were very interesting. The first one that I found really interesting was leasing federal land, do not sell it. Leasing federal land, do not sell it. That means that 25% of the proceeds from the lease can go towards retiring the federal debt. 25% from the lease can go towards the federal agency that is responsible for the real estate. 25% to the hosting state. And 25% to the federal treasury. Tell us, what historical precedent would this overturn, and why is this a good thing for our country?
Well, the way we funded the government from the beginning of our current constitution was selling land. Dividing up the Northwest Territory, and then the Louisiana Purchase, and then all the way to the Alaska Territory. And this was a very successful way of pouring money into the coffers of the Treasury. When we built the railroads, when we built the superhighways, we would sell the easements or give the easements to developers and give them land, and this would bring money into the coffers. Well, now we're in the 21st century, and we have an enormous amount of federal land, like a lot of the casinos in Las Vegas, for instance, were land that was owned by the BLM that we sell. But most real estate developers, if not all, whenever they have precious real estate, they no longer sell it. They lease the land, and we should be doing that with the federal land. Do 99-year leases. That way people don't have to come up with a lot of cash. They can use their money to develop the property. And then we have an income every month coming in, and the state gets 25%. If it's national park land, they get 25%. If it's BLM land, they get the 25%. The Treasury gets the 25%, and the rest goes to retire the debt. And it's just a 21st century way of doing business, and we just need to apply to the federal government. After 99 years, you renew the lease, or you get the land back. The people get the land back. And it would be a very simple way to pour billions of dollars into the Treasury of the United States and have the people still.
It piqued my interest. You say repeal U.S. Public Law 62-5, and for those of you who don't know, that's the law that sets the limit of the House of Representatives' number of members to 435. We actually did a show on this earlier this month. So how would repealing that actually benefit us? I mean, first of all, wouldn't that increase the number of representatives that we'd have to have?
Well, the way the founders put together the Constitution is the House of Representatives belonged to the people. And when they were trying to get it passed and ratified, many, many states, especially New York, felt that there wasn't enough congressmen. that were going to be. They were starting off at 65, or about one per 40,000. James Madison in the Federalist Papers wrote a beautiful argument stating that the whole idea of the House of Representatives is that the members would be known like you would know your neighbor, like a small town councilman or a small town mayor. And he talked about how within 50 years, the House of Representatives would be up to 435. And the big argument that they had was they were afraid that Congress, if there were too many people being represented by one person, then people with money could influence that person because they had reached him, or the newspapers that back then could influence that people because they would need the newspapers to get elected. So they always wanted to keep the representatives low. So up until 1912, Congress grew to about 435 individuals, and at that time it was about one per 80, 90,000 people. And then the Progressive Republicans came in, backed by William Randolph Hearst, who really wanted to have more impact on congressional elections, and they pushed through Public Law 62-5, which limited the House of Representatives. So we had 20 political parties in the first 120 years with 5% or more birthing and representing the people. And since then, we've only had two political parties with 5% or more. We've basically, the people have lost their house. It's one person per 713,000 people. Every 2 years, that person has to raise a couple million dollars to get reelected. And you don't know your representative. Your representative doesn't know you. And I'm down here to speak this weekend, you know, on the mall for the festivities on 9/12. And what they're really screaming about here is no taxation without proper representation. They don't have a voice. The people don't have a voice in the House of Representatives because they don't know their congressman. And if you extrapolate what happened the first 120 years into the last 100 years, we would have about 2,400 congressmen and women on the Hill. And all you would do is they would be doing a lot of the job that the 16,000 staff people are currently doing. So right now we got 435 Congress members on the Hill with 435 of them congresspeople. But under the plan, if they never had that law, we would have 2,400 congressmen and probably about 8,000 or 9,000 staff members. And these congressmen would be going back to their districts and knowing the people, why these 16,000 people here on the Hill basically live in the district. And you can go into any congressman's office and you'll find out that very few of the people who work for him or her are not from their district. They're professionals that have lived in the Beltway, that have jumped from congressman, congresswoman, back and forth. And that isn't what the founders intended. Hmm. And if you people really want a voice in the House of Representatives, you got to get it down to 2,400 people, which is about 120,000, 130,000, about 70,000 registered voters. And then an ordinary guy can run, an ordinary woman can run. They don't have to be a multimillionaire or have a special interest group. And also they'll know what their neighbors want. They to have a real voice. And that was what the founders intended. And we kind of, the Progressive Republicans kind of blew it back in 1912.
Wow, that's an impassioned argument from Stan Klaus, everybody, historian, adjunct professor, author of the book Economic Home Runs. And we're talking about his 13 plans for getting us back on a fiscal sound footing. We've just covered a couple of them. The next one that was interesting to me, because I believe that the medical profession has a monopoly on it, is expand medical, nursing, and healthcare education institutions to double the rate at which the U.S. currently graduates doctors and nurses. How would this benefit us?
Well, you know, in 1911, we had 155 medical schools, and the problem was they weren't coordinating their teaching. What the American Medical Association did is they did a Flexner study. That's what it was called. And he went out and he did a study, and basically it was his decision and his recommendation that the medical schools would all be tied to universities. They would shrink the number. They would make the training, I guess what you would call it, standardized. And they basically adopted his plan. And so you went from a large amount of medical schools putting out doctors to a very small amount, to the point where it was only very wealthy white males that could afford it, and basically that model has been followed. It's medical schools attached to universities that are very expensive to do. And what brought my attention to this is we have a huge shortage of doctors and nurses.
That's right.
In the United States. In fact, we need about 50% more just to get to where we're at. Today, we have a different model of education. That is, a student can sit in a classroom and watch the best medical professor teach via the internet on a widescreen, and you can bring the best professors and intellects in terms of teaching these kids. So you take a state like Idaho, where I went to Idaho State University, mm-hmm. and I did my bachelor's there. The entire state doesn't even have a medical school. My alma mater was telling me Idaho State University, they have a good nursing school. They're telling me they're in the running, but the other two universities don't have it. An entire state doesn't have a medical school, and it's all because of this Flexner study. So what we need to do is we need a new study on medical education, not only for doctors, but also for nurses, where we can double the amount of graduates, double the amount of schools, so we can educate our youth, who will become much better citizens, health-conscious citizens, and can begin to care for the 78 million baby boomers. And right now, 25% of all the doctors in the United States are actually trained in foreign medical schools because we can't fill the slots. And they're not even getting the training at the level that we should be getting here in the United States.
Oh.
So increase the medical schools. Let's bring in the internet. Let's bring in the training. Let's change the model and double the rate of doctors and nurses in this country. And it's really going to help our healthcare crisis.
That's the kind of entrepreneurial thinking that we like to hear from Stan Kloss, who is the author of the book Economic Home Runs. Stan, another one here that just absolutely piqued my interest. You say implement the metric system at the federal, state, and local levels. Hey, we tried that back in the 70s and it bombed. Why would it work now, and why would it help?
Well, we've tried it. We've tried it. Oh, I don't know how many different enactments that we've had. We've had about five since 1975 with the Metric Conversion Act, and basically, it's only us and Burma, and Burma's got a different name, and Liberia are the only countries in the entire world that doesn't use the metric system, and it really hurts us in terms of competitive bidding and analysis. When we're trying to go into international markets. I mean, we're just using a whole different type of system. And we really got to get serious about that. We really got to make the conversion with the children, beginning with the children, beginning with the highway system, beginning with the easy things, so we can standardize with the rest of the world. I mean, we're definitely beating to the wrong drum there. I mean, us, Liberia and Burma, I mean, come on, let's wake up and let's get competitive.
All right. That's Stan Kloss, everybody, using some entrepreneurial thinking about things we could do at the governmental level to get us back on track. Another one of your 13 items that I found interesting was reconsider the old Shakespeare expression, the first thing we do is let's kill all the lawyers. Now, I agree with you, lawyers are necessary, but why should we reevaluate our thinking towards lawyers?
Well, you know, people don't understand that we had a constitution before we had our current U.S. Constitution, and it failed. And it failed miserably, and the country was in complete chaos. And when they went to go fix that constitution, they couldn't fix it. They had to throw the whole darn thing out and start all over again. And that constitution has served us very, very well. And people have to understand, without good, sound laws, and good legal minds to interpret the laws, you know, we wouldn't have the civilization and society that we have. And yes, God knows I have such difficulties with attorneys these days, and there's definitely room for tort reform. But people have to understand that the law and the officers of the court are the true stalwarts of liberty and freedom, because it's the law, after all, the Constitution and the laws that are enacted within it that have given us this great society that we had. And believe me, we almost blew it all in the first 15 years under the Articles of Confederation. You know, we just got to focus on improving the law, focus on tort reform, and stop blaming the lawyers.
I hate to agree with you on that point, Stan Kloss, but I have to agree with you there. It's been wonderful. We're going to have to end it there, Stan. But if people want to learn more about it, find out about your book, Economic Home Runs, where would you direct them?
Just go to economichomeruns.com, economichomeruns.com, and there, all 13 points in detail are listed there. And the book, of course, explains how we arrived at these different conclusions, basically taking from history. These are sound principles in history that have worked before and adapting them to the 21st century.
We love it, Stan. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
I thoroughly enjoyed this brainstorming. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Stan. Talk to you later.